Welcome to the Issue Is Podcast Extra. I'm Alex Michelson. This is where we get to spend more time with our panelists, dig into some of the issues, and we've got Gustavo Arellano here for the first time. Welcome to The Issue Is.
No, gracias for having me. I'm still high on your mom's brownies.
That's right. So my mom bakes cookies and brownies for our guests every week. A big shout out to Crystal Michelson, who no doubt is listening right now. Thank you. Thank you for being here. You've been a columnist in L.A. for years. Just in the last year, you started in the L.A. Times as part of Patrick Soon-Shiong. Let's spend some money and get some of the best people in L.A. to start working for the paper and sort of revitalizing journalism in Los Angeles. And as part of, actually, we had him as a guest right after he started. And he said, one of the most important things I want to do is start podcasting because that's where the world is at. And we need to invest more money in that. And clearly, he's made good on that. And part of that is this Is California podcast, which your first conversation, first episodes are about this Proposition 187, which is really interesting. I want to bring in also Terry Eisman, our intern, is here for the conversation. Hi, Terry.
I appreciate you having me once again. I think, Gustavo, you have an excellent story to tell. We're really excited to hear it.
No, yes. Gracias again.
Okay, so Prop 187. Today, actually, the day that we're taping this, is the 25th anniversary of Prop 187. For people that have been in California politics a long time, they know this is one of the most important things ever. For people that are maybe a little younger, they're like, what the hell is that? So what is Prop 187?
The log line. 1994 ballot initiative overwhelmingly passed by California voters that sought to make life miserable for undocumented immigrants, but instead turned California into a super blue state, but also paved the way for Donald Trump to be able to run and win on anti-immigration rhetoric.
So back in 1994, California didn't necessarily look like it does now politically. We had a Republican governor, right? There were Republicans in the state legislature. There were Republicans in Congress. Can you imagine that?
in Los Angeles County, no less. Yeah, Dick Mountjoy.
And certainly plenty in Orange County as well. And then there was a fight over illegal immigration, which is still a giant fight today.
It never ends.
And the story of how 187 actually got started in Orange County is really fascinating.
Yeah, so let's take back early 1990s. California is going through a recession. We just suffered through the LA riots, earthquakes, drought. People are looking for a scapegoat, and illegal immigration is the group that people are beating up on. Pete Wilson's campaigned against it. State assembly members, state senators, they're trying to pass laws about it. But the thing that changed everything, 187, was started by a gadfly in Orange County named Ron Prince, who had some friends who said, hey, you're trying to pass a ballot initiative. Here, let's try it every weekend. You go out. No one's signing up for anything that he wrote. Finally, he puts one day on top of his little ledger, do you believe illegal immigration is a problem in California? That Saturday, he comes back with hundreds of signatures. His friends, who are Republican consultants who worked in the Reagan White House, are like, well, we promised you we'd help you out, so we might as well go with it.
And these friends of his didn't necessarily even believe in the concept of Prop 187, right? Them in your podcast.
Barbara and Bob Kiley, longtime Republican consultants. Barbara was a mayor of Yorba Linda at the time, and she told me, like, you know, up in Yorba Linda, we had no problem with illegal immigration. We had no idea that it was a problem. But we had this friend, Ron Prince, who was really adamant about trying to do something about illegal immigration. So we're going to connect them with people that we know. As it happened to be, these were former officials with the INS. These were anti-immigrant zealots. It was the perfect storm, all done on a fluke.
And the irony is where this idea came was dinner at a certain restaurant.
Yeah, well, what happened, so they thought of the idea for 187, but they wanted to give their campaign a name. And so they go to El Torito. After four margaritas, they find it. Save Our State. And what I loved about it in the podcast, I asked her, like, what was the inspiration? And Barbara Kiley just almost deadpans, like, four margaritas at El Torito. And then my response was, damn. Hey, El Torito does not have bad margaritas, by the way.
Yes, yes. But literally a Mexican restaurant is where all this was.
People might hate Mexicans, but they love the Mexican food. That is the story of Mexican food in the United States. So it wasn't surprising. It's such an Orange County thing also to do.
Right. And so when people think about Prop 187 today, it would probably never have a chance of passing in California. But not only did it pass in California, passed pretty big.
59% to 41%. And again, just to show you how much things have changed, 25 years ago, you had Democrats campaigning against illegal immigration. You had Dianne Feinstein saying she's going to be tough on the border. She's going to try to limit benefits to illegal immigrants. You would never hear that from Democrats in California in this day. They would be branded traitors. They would be branded Republicans. You even had Latino Democrats campaigning against illegal immigration coming from East Los Angeles. But this campaign, this 187 campaign, just changed everything. And again, made California into that progress. You made it into a place where not only is it Democrat, but some of the bigger stars are Latinos. And all of those Latinos, they're of the generation that walked out from college or high schools during the 187 years.
I don't know if you were thinking about this at all or you were making it, but as I was listening to your podcast, I was thinking a lot about Proposition 8 in California. Mm. This was the same-sex marriage ban that was passed in 2008 on the same election that Barack Obama won. And I think there were so many people in the LGBTQ community who thought that that could never happen here and didn't even necessarily think that they needed to get out and vote about that issue. And after that happened, they felt so uncomfortable that their state was essentially saying you don't matter as much, that they became so politically engaged. And it seems like Prop 187 was a very similar thing. I mean, for you, as a Mexican-American in Southern California, what did you feel like that night that Prop 187 passed?
I honestly couldn't believe it. I did not even learn about 187 until October. I was a sophomore of 94. I was like literally a little bit more than a month before the election. I was a sophomore in high school, Anaheim High. I'm walking home. A truckload of white boys start yelling at me, 187, 187. And I'm like, what? 187? What the hell is that? I get home. I turn on the TV. I find out what it is. And I'm like, that's really ugly and mean. My dad came to this country in the trunk of a Chevy. And so when 187, that was literally the first time in my life I had ever realized that people might hate people for where they came from, people mm-hmm. hating immigrants or specifically Mexicans. And it disturbed me. And so what I try to do after that, I just try to stay away from politics. I enrolled at Orange Coast College in Costa Mesa. I was going to be the Brown Scorsese or Tarantino. And then, one kind of like Godfather 3, just when I thought I could get away from 187, it pulled me back in.
Hmm. What was the moment that the political equation in California shifted?
Arguably 1996. So this is 2 years after 187 passes. Loretta Sanchez is running for Congress. She beats Bob Dornan in Orange County.
What's his nickname again?
B1 Bob.
B1 Bob.
Good old B1 Bob.
Because he was a big defense spender.
Yeah, he was a big blowhard is what he was. and it sent shockwaves. Now, of course, everyone's still in shock that Orange County's congressional delegation is all blue. But this was the beginning with Loretta being able to win. And she only won by like 900 and some votes. And it's because all these Latinos were starting to register as Democrats. That's 96. Then you go on, 98. I mean, you have the entire generation. The Democratic Latinos Republicans love to hate. Fabian Nunez, Antonio Villaraigosa, Anthony Rendon, Kevin De Leon, Cruz Bustamante, all these people were in college or a little bit younger, a little bit older, and they were all active in the campaign against 187. The whole state changed forever because of this proposition.
Yeah, and Antonio became a community activist, Antonio Villaraigosa.
Antonio was a labor activist at the time, then became mayor. Kevin De Leon, in the podcast, I didn't make it. This cut didn't make it in, but Kevin literally said, look, none of us ever wanted to be in politics. We thought we were too radical. We thought the political process was too sellout. But after this, we look at ourselves and think, one of us should run for office. How about you? Then you. Then you. Kevin was the last one. Kevin mm-hmm. was the last one. I mean, he obviously got termed out of office, ran against Dianne Feinstein for Senate in 2018. But he was the last one. Now you have a generation even younger than them that learned from the bottle of 187, hey, we got to fight even stronger than ever before.
Yeah, and Kevin De Leon became the Senate President pro tem, one of the most powerful positions in California, perhaps, other than governor. Terry, want to get in the conversation?
Sure. I actually want to quickly go back to sort of how this started, because as you know, in the aftermath of the passage of this initiative, there were many protests, right? but you weren't among the protesters, right? And you just write about your non-decision to do that. Do you regret that, and why? Why weren't you part of the protest if you feel so passionately about
it? So in the weeks before the 187 vote, tens of thousands of high schoolers across California marched out. The biggest one was November 3rd. My high school, Anaheim High, we walked out en masse during lunchtime. They just knocked down the fence and woof, off we go. But I didn't do it. I remember going to my fifth period history class. I was like one of five students there. And we all looked at each other. We're just like, damn, we're cowards. And I didn't do it. I'll admit it. I was scared. I was scared that the police would go after me. I was scared that immigration would go after my parents. They weren't American citizens at the time. And I also have to admit, I was skeptical. I didn't think that marching would solve anything. I actually think that marching would anger middle-of-the-road voters that would then make it harder for 187 to be able to fail. In that sense, I got proven right. But the problem, the interesting thing, not a problem, is that almost all my classmates at Anaheim High, that would be their only moment ever of political activism. The following day, it was like business as usual. The one who didn't walk, I'm the one who then devoted his entire career to try to repudiate everything that 187 and one of its big backers, former Governor Pete Wilson, stood for.
And Gloria Molina, the former LA County Supervisor, makes the point in your podcast that during those marches, many of the people were carrying Mexican flags,
yeah,
not American flags. And that really turned off a lot of people.
Oh, she said the visual was horrific. That was her word. Yeah. It was horrible. It was like, no, she said, I was horrified. Barbara and Bob Kiley, it's like, hey, you gave us a gift. Because,
right?
Of course, middle-of-the-road voters, they see the Mexican flag. They're like, well, this is an invasion. I don't agree with the decision, but I get it. Look, you have been told for an entire summer, you're a dirty Mexican, you're ruining this country. And the way Mexicans are, not to stereotype, but we're going to be like, oh yeah, you think we're dirty Mexicans? Here's your dirty Mexican. Here's that Mexican flag and wrap around it. But I have to say, those the expression of ethnic pride really galvanized those people to then be able to move on and do the things that they did today.
Do you think that the architects of this initiative thought that the Latino population would stay quiet about this? Like, how do you think they envisioned this would actually work?
They only thought that the Latinos they knew, which were either second or third generation or naturalized citizens, that they would vote for the initiative. In fact, when the first polling came out about 187, Latino voters, they supported the measure. There really was this idea that illegal immigrants, like maybe it was different in the past, but now illegal immigrants are really ruining things. But once the campaign starts unfolding, once you start seeing these commercials that show Latinos as this invading force, once you see these activists talking about an invasion. And
right.
Spanish being spoken, that's when Latinos realized, oh, okay, you're not against illegal immigration. You're scared about the culture wars. You think that we're going to take over California? Yeah. So at the end, 73% of Latino voters voted against 187.
Let's talk about where we're at now, because you got President Trump, who ran on build a wall. The first thing he said when he came out was, you know, Latinos or Mexicans are sending us rapists and criminals, and some, I assume, are good people.
Exactly. Infamous words.
And that was the foundation of his campaign.
And he won.
And still is. How did you feel that night on November of 2016?
It's funny because I was the editor of the OC Weekly at the time. And all my, you know, where's a liberal leftist newspaper. So all my colleagues thought Trump was going to lose, Hillary was going to win. So I have to think, we have to put a cover to bed. Like, you know, we have our printing deadlines on Tuesday, and we only had a cover of Hillary mopping the floor with Trump. So I told my art director, I'm like, Trump's going to win. At the very, like, he only had 15 minutes to turn into, like, a Trump as the winner cover. And so that night, I had to comfort a lot of my colleagues. They were crying. They were drunk. I was drunk just because I like to get drunk sometimes. So
yeah. Margaritas are great at El Torito.
Margaritas are great at El Torito. Exactly. Hey, you know me too well already.
Yeah.
But what I said to my, because all my workers were younger than me, and I said, look, this has happened before. This has happened with 187. This too shall pass. Maybe not right now. Maybe not for the next 4 years. But again, Latinos, we have, especially Mexican Americans, we have a long, long, long memory, and we're always out for retribution.
Why do you think on the national level that we haven't seen more Latino leadership? We've seen a lot of Latino leadership on the state level, but we have not seen sort of the, you know, the, the way that we have in other races.
Yeah, you have to think we're relatively young in terms of getting political activism or political power. Really, you don't start seeing the first elected Latino officials until the 1950s and 1960s. In the 70s and 80s, you start seeing some people. Henry Cisneros probably being the most prominent person. He had a cabinet position in the Clinton White House.
Secretary of Housing.
Secretary of Housing, thank you. And so ever since then, I think more Latinos have – I think the bigger strategy is get power on the local level, and hopefully one of them will rise up to the national level. Right now you have Julian Castro.
Yeah, what do you make of him? He seems to be struggling in the polls.
Yeah, because people don't really know what to do with a Latino candidate. They think, aren't you supposed to be speaking Spanish? You're brown. Like, you're not supposed to be running for things. And, nothing against him. I like him. I think he's done good in San Antonio, but he doesn't exactly have the most, the most original platform. His whole platform is decriminalize immigration, which, hey, it's great and all, but that's not going to win you anything at all. So he's just seen as like, okay, you're an important person for running, but who's going to be the great brown hope? We don't have one out there. It used to be Villaraigosa, and we all know what happened to him.
Is speaking Spanish a boon for him, do you think?
It's not, I don't think, at the end, because Latinos, they don't care if you speak How Spanish or English. And then for non-Latino voters, I don't know. Once you start speaking a language that's not English, people start freaking out. Which to me, I'm like, come on. Like, the more languages, the better. I wish more of our presidential candidates knew more than one language.
Mayor Pete knows five.
Oh, yeah, well, because he's a freaking Army Ranger. Or, he served and he's smart.
Yeah, but Beto would use the Spanish, and he got mocked for doing it a lot.
Yeah, because, again, for Latinos, they see a white guy speaking Spanish, and they're like, oh, you're hispandering to us. You can't do anything else. You think by speaking Spanish to us, we're going to get your vote? No. So you can't rely on Latinos as being a monolithic vote. The Democrats have gotten away with it for a long, long time in California, but eventually they have to offer more than just saying we're not the party of Pete Wilson.
Yeah, let's
or
talk
Trump.
Let's talk a little bit about you. So you long time at the OC Weekly. A lot of people knew some of the stuff that you had done there, and now you're at the LA Times. I mean, what's that like? And have they were you fearful at all that they would try to kind of rein you in a little bit?
I it was a daily newspaper. This is only the second job I've ever had as an adult. The first, okay. I was with the OC Weekly for 17 years. I was used to getting things my way because I was the boss. And I didn't have to be the boss. So I was just afraid that they wouldn't like my story ideas. I was afraid that, the newsroom would be filled with a bunch of jealous people backstabbing, because that's how newsrooms used to be. But everyone's been so polite, so kind, supportive beyond belief. They've allowed me to do the stories that I want. And obviously, I can't cuss the way I used to be at OC Weekly. I can't do stream of consciousness crap. But they allow me to do stories in any way. They allowed me to do this podcast. I had never done a podcast before. They allowed me to take 2 months, which is really quick time for everything that we did, but they allowed me to take 2 months to do the podcast in the way that I wanted to do it. I did it in collaboration with NPR's Latino USA. Right. I did a couple of essays and articles surrounding it, and they've been happy with it. They're telling me, okay, what's the next podcast? I'm like, I haven't even thought that far off.
Well, the next podcast is a conversation you just did with Pete Wilson, right?
Yeah, that's the next podcast episode. Yeah, so in the original Battle of 187 of my podcast, I was trying to get the former governor of California, Pete Wilson, who really won his campaign on battling illegal immigration and eventually embrace illegal 187, so much so that now when you talk about to voters in California and you mention Pete Wilson, they forget that he was senator. They forget that he was mayor of San Diego. They just associate him with 187.
Right.
So we couldn't get the interview in time for the podcast, but he was kind enough to sit down with me for an hour and a half. And
wow.
We talked for a long, long time about issues. And we agreed to disagree at the end, but I think it's going to make for some interesting radio.
Did you hug it out?
We shook hands.
You shook hands. He doesn't seem like much of a hugger.
No. He's of a previous generation. He said the word ass in front of my producer, who's a woman, and he looks at her and touches her on the shoulder and says, oh, I'm sorry I said that.
Yeah.
Old school, for better or for worse. It's a different generation.
Yeah. Any last questions, Terry?
Well, I was, you were smack dab in the middle of this phenomenon, right, as it unraveled. What does it mean to you to be able to produce this podcast as someone who is in the center of it, as a Latino, as a child who was at the receiving end of 187, like, what does this mean to you?
It is insane that I'm even doing this. It wasn't my idea to do something about 187. It was my editor, Hector Becerra. He mm-hmm. comes to me one day and says, hey, you should do something about 187. It's the 25th anniversary. And I laughed and I said, I am like the worst person to do this because I am so biased on the issue. I've spent my entire career talking trash on 187 and its supporters. But then he said, that's why you're the best person to do it. Like, it took Nixon to go to China. You're the one to be able to do it. Obviously, we'll make sure you don't go too far off the rails, but go off and do reporting. And that's what I did. I talked to Barbara Kiley. I talked to Peter Nunez, one of the architects of 187. I talked to Pete Wilson. I didn't stage any Borat-style hijinks. Like, you know, apologize. You're a racist. That's dumb. I was a reporter through and through. So it means a lot to me that I was able to tell my story. I never thought I'd be able to do that sort of stuff at the LA Times. But kudos to the LA Times for thinking of being able to do stories away from the just straightforward objective narratives.
Well, and what I really like about that is it is an example that I think we can all learn from in all politics these days of actually sitting down and having a conversation with somebody that you may disagree with, but it'd be civil and you can learn from each other.
There's going to be people, I predict, that are going to hear my conversation with Governor Wilson and say, you're a sellout. You had the opportunity to scream and take revenge on behalf of all these millions of Latinos of your generation, and instead you had a conversation with him. Instead, you called him governor. How dare you? And my response is, what do you want me to do? If me yelling at him, that's not going to gain me anything.
Right.
I'd rather have a polite conversation and maybe, hopefully, not change his mind, but at least get him on the record to talk about these issues and challenge him. Like,
right.
You know, I'll save it for the podcast, but really quickly, I gave him this example. I said, look, my cousins, they're socially conservative. They would have probably voted Republican, but they think you are racist. How do you respond to them? And he had a response, and his response, well, it was wrong. It was completely wrong. and he did not like the response that I had to his response.
Right. But at least you're having a dialogue, which is what – and that's really the whole purpose of our show as well.
Exactly. At the end, we shook hands. I thanked him, and I meant it. Like, and they even said, like, you know, you held up to your end of the bargain. In other words, you didn't make a show out of it, and we held up to our end of the bargain. And at the end, hey, that's all we asked for.
Right. And then in our case, everybody can have cookies and brownies together.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I didn't get brownies from Governor Wilson.
Yeah. So more reason to come back to us.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming in, and thank you for the work you do. So everybody, please listen to that podcast. You can check it out at the LA Times podcast as well. Search for Prop 187 and search The Issue Is. You can listen to the other podcast that we did today with Gustavo, which is also with John Thomas and with Jessica Levinson and Adam Schiff, a conversation about a lot going on in politics, including impeachment and this new thing that's happening in Vegas and comes to housing. So thank you again. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe. Please like us. Please rate us. Please tell your friends about us. Tell your friends about his podcast. That's how we get the word out about this stuff. Share in social media. And we'll see you next time for more of The Issue Is.